Hi, Dave Emmer here. Side 2, for the record, program number 760, Bitcoinberg, The Rebels Without a Clue. This program is being recorded on October 27th of the year 2013. We're taking a slight detour from our discussion of the adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, although, obviously, for those of you who heard Side 1, this is directly tangential to that entire discussion. We're taking a look at the genesis and functions of the virtual currency called Bitcoin, B-I-T-C-O-I, and hence the title, Bitcoinberg. We're going to plunge right into our analysis, and a column about Bitcoin was penned by Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist and columnist with the New York Times. Paul Krugman called his column of April 14th of 2013 the anti-social network, and it reads as follows. Bitcoin's wild ride may not have been the biggest story of the past few weeks, but it was surely the most entertaining. Over the course of less than 2 weeks, the price of the digital currency more than tripled. Then it fell more than 50% in a few hours. Suddenly, it felt as if we were back in the dot-com era. The economic significance of this roller coaster was basically nil, but the furor over Bitcoin was a useful lesson in the ways people misunderstand money, and in particular, how they are misled by the desire to divorce the value of money from the society it serves. What is Bitcoin? It's sometimes described as a way to make transactions online, but that in itself would be nothing new in the world of online credit card and PayPal transactions. In fact, the Commerce Department estimates that by 2010, about 16% of total sales in America already took the form of e-commerce. So how is Bitcoin different? Unlike credit card transactions, which leave a digital trail, Bitcoin transactions are designed to be anonymous and untraceable. When you transfer Bitcoins to someone else, it's as if you handed over a paper bag filled with $100 bills in a dark alley. And sure enough, as best as anyone can tell, the main use of Bitcoin so far, other than as a target for speculation, has been for online versions of those dark alley exchanges with bitcoins traded for narcotics and other illegal items. But Bitcoin evangelists insist that it's about much more than greasing the path for illicit transactions. The biggest declared investors in Bitcoins are the Winklevoss brothers, wealthy twins who successfully sued for a share of Facebook and were made famous by the movie The Social Network, and they make claims for the digital product similar to those made by gold bugs for their favorite metal. "We have elected," declared Tyler Winklevoss recently, "to put our money and faith in a mathematical framework that is free of politics and human error," unquote. The similarity to the gold bug rhetoric isn't a coincidence, since gold bugs and Bitcoin enthusiasts, Bitbugs, tend to share both libertarian politics and the belief that governments are vastly abusing their power to print money. At the same time, it's very peculiar, since Bitcoins are, in a sense, the ultimate fiat currency with a value conjured out of thin air. Gold's value comes in part because it has non-monetary uses such as filling teeth and making jewelry. Paper currencies have value because they're backed by the power of the state, which defines them as legal tender and accepts them as payment for taxes. Bitcoins, however, derive their value, if any, from purely self-fulfilling prophecy, the belief that other people will accept them as payment. However, let's leave that strangeness on one side, along with the peculiar mining process, actually a process of complex calculation used to add to the Bitcoin stock. Instead, let's focus on the two huge misconceptions, one practical, one philosophical, that underlie both goldbugism and bitbugism. The practical misconceptions here, and it's a big one, is the notion that we live in an era of wildly irresponsible money printing with runaway inflation just around the corner. It's true that the Federal Reserve and other central banks have greatly expanded their balance sheets, but they've done that explicitly as a temporary measure in response to economic crisis. I know government officials are not to be trusted in all that, but the truth is that Ben Bernanke's promises that his actions wouldn't be inflationary have been vindicated year after year, while Goldbug's dire warnings of inflation keep not coming true. The philosophical misconception, however, seems to be even bigger. Goldbugs and bitbugs alike seem to long for a pristine monetary standard untouched by human frailty. But that is an impossible dream. Money is, as Paul Samuelson once declared, a social contrivance, unquote, not something that stands outside society. Even when people relied on gold and silver coins, what made those coins useful wasn't the precious metals they contained. It was the expectation that other people would accept them as payment. Actually, you'd expect the Winklevosses of all people to get this, because in a way, money is like a social network which is useful only to the extent that other people use it. But I guess some people are just bothered by the notion that money is a human thing and want the benefits of the monetary network without the social part. Sorry, it can't be done. So do we need a new form of money? I guess you could make that case if the money we actually have were misbehaving, but it is not. We have huge economic problems, but green pieces of paper are doing fine, and we should let them alone. That again from Paul Krugman's column of April 14th. Of 2013. Now, Paul Krugman noted the wild fluctuation in the price of bitcoins, and a very important article is included in a post, by the way, that is from my post called Bitcoinberg 2, and I published that just this past Friday, October 25th of 2013, and all of the articles either excerpted or referenced in this broadcast will be in the written description for the Record Program 760 in the For the Record category on the SpitfireList.com website. Now, a very important and also highly technical discussion of the manipulation of Bitcoin was carried in an article, a very important article that I'm going to excerpt briefly here, and that is excerpted at much greater length and linked in the Bitcoinberg 2 post and will be in the written description for this program, was in the folkvinja.net website or blog of September 20th of 2013. This is authored by Rick Falkvinge. I don't know how that's pronounced. F-A-L-K-V-I-N-G-E. And again, the blog is falkvinge.net. Now, Mr. Falkvinge is highly intelligent, as evidenced by this exhaustive and very detailed and very technical analysis of the illegal manipulation of Bitcoin. I would also note that the integrity manifested by Mr. Falkvinge is quite evident here. He is a supporter of Bitcoin, and yet he despairs at the obvious abuse of the ultimate fiat currency, as Paul Krugman called it. This post is titled, Bitcoin's Vast Overvaluation Appears Partially Caused by Usually Illegal Price Fixing, again by Rick Falkvinge, at Falkvinge, F-A-L-K-V-I-N-G-E dot. That's September 20th of the year 2013. Now, this discussion, like Adam Pennenberg's discussion of the patents involved with the minting of Bitcoin, so to speak, is highly technical and I think would make very poor recitation on the radio. Also, in the actual article, there are some very well-done graphs, which are essential for the understanding of this. I am simply going to read the first two paragraphs and then leave it to the more and enterprising and detail-minded listeners to flesh out their understanding. Now, in this article, again, Bitcoin's vast overvaluation appears partially caused by usually illegal price fixing, we read. In securities trading, the expression painting the tape is used for any trading activity that is intended to manipulate the trading statistics, price, volume, or other metrics, rather than to execute a trade. It is highly illegal, jail time illegal in all civilized parts of the world. The expression comes from the ancient price ticker tape and how it could be painted, unquote, with false data. He, by the way, he posits a group of manipulators he calls the Shark Squad. It's unclear who they are or where they are. I have noted in For the Record program 327, among other broadcasts, of the short selling that was engaged in on September 22, 1963, and in the run-up to September 11th of 2001. The evidence available points in the direction of the Underground Reich and the Bormann Network. I suspect, and this is pure suspicion, but I suspect that the Shark Squad is German / Bormann / BND. In any event, though, as Rick Falkvinge points out, somebody is playing serious games with Bitcoin and engaging in an activity that is jail time illegal. Continuing with his analysis, I'm going to illustrate how this Shark Squad has operated recently to fix the price in luring other traders of their money and hiking the price. While luring other traders of their money is part of the game, there are legal and illegal ways to do so. Insider trading, for example, is one of the better-known illegal ones. Our legal framework generally fights hard to create a level playing field for all traders. The squad, the Shark Squad, is a small team of collaborating traders. And then he engages in a very technical discussion. I'll just read you one short excerpt to give you an idea. In step one of the cycle, the Shark Squad makes a large buy-up, causing prices to skyrocket. Illustrated here, the buy-up at 10 o'clock European time on Thursday, September 12th of 2013, from $135 to $145.9, an instant 8% increase. This causes a lot of downward betting traders to flush out. In step two, the Shark Squad reverses this trend by causing a slow pullback, causing those who bought in greed to sell off in panic as the market has reversed, and causing more stop losses to trigger and people to sell to the squad's bids. And he then goes on to analyze this in very detailed and technical terms with graphs. The point being here that this supposed new horizon currency, this revolution in currency, is being gamed in the same bloody damn ways that others. These basically are a bunch of crooked one percenters, and really, really, what else could be expected with something like this? The point being that Bitcoin is not, as its advocates maintain, the answer to the problem, unquote, as Paul Krugman noted it, of currency. It is, in fact, the same old bloody business. It is, literally, crooked business as usual. By the way, I would note in Paul Krugman's discussion, Edward Snowden is among those who talks about how the term I can't use on the air, that expletive deleted Bernanke is making the dollar worthless and so forth. This in the same post he made in 2009 when posted to Geneva with the Central Intelligence Agency, in which he advocated eliminating Social Security and going back to the gold standard. That's why this whole discussion about Bitcoin is part and parcel to Mr. Get Rid of Social Security and Bring Back the Gold Standard himself, Eddie the Friendly Spook. We've already seen many of the same elements that loom large in Snowden's political background and foreground, frankly, at play here as well. Now, we're going to come back to these shenanigans in Washington and how they have shaken confidence in the status of the dollar as a reserve, the world's reserve currency of choice, precisely because of this nonsense by the shutdown nearly of the Palestinian Libertarian Organization, as we've noted last week and the week before. The elements that figure in Edward Snowden's milieu are the elements who are doing exactly the same thing. And what they were doing politically in Washington with their shenanigans is what Eddie the Friendly Spook has been doing with his, quote, disclosures, unquote, much of which has been on the record for years, and the rest of which pretty much could be safely and intelligently extrapolated, and which is business as usual for intelligence agencies. There also appears to have been some releasing of information about the identities and family members of U.S. and British intelligence operatives. That has nothing to do with concern for civil liberties. That is hostile counterintelligence. We will talk about that in the future. Now, recall that in the Fast Company article by Adam Pennenberg, he hypothesizes that three men, he doesn't realize that all three were employed by the same company, Charles Bry, Neil J. King, and Vladimir Oxman of a company called Vontik, were actually behind the creation of Bitcoin, not the rumored and somewhat mysterious Satoshi Nakamoto. I noted that Vontik was a joint venture of Infineon AG, a Siemens spinoff with Golden Gate Capital, and we took a look at how Golden Gate Capital was in turn formed by alumni of Bain Capital. Bain Capital was the company of Mitt Romney. I was off the air during the 2012 campaign, so we're going to revisit some of the Vermittler, as I call them. Vermittler is the German word for agent, and that's what I termed Mitt Romney. Two very good posts by Joseph Cannon, C-A-N-N-O-N, on his Cannon Fire website are the sources for this. I think due to the limitations of time, I'm not going to read the actual excerpts. They are in my descriptions, in my posts about Bain Capital, and they will be in the description for this broadcast. Now, first of all, we're going to take a look at a post from July 5th. Well, my post is from July 9th of 2012. It's called More About the Vermittler and Cannon Shot, More About the Vermittler and His Offshore Accounts. This, in turn, accesses the post Bain, Romney, Spooks, and Death Squads by Joseph Cannon, that from his Cannon Fire website of July 5th of 2012. Cannon Fire, C-A-N-N-O-N-F-I-R-E, one word. Joseph Cannon, last name, just as in the artillery piece. Summing up the information, and it is excerpted here, I note here, the Vermittler continues to be paid by Bain Capital more than 10 years after he left the firm. Why? The Vermittler's trusts don't appear to be nearly as blind as they are represented as being. One of the original investors in Bain Capital was the late Robert Maxwell, who had strong connections with Israeli intelligence. In the past, we have noted the Vermittler's links to Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli right wing. The Maxwell association with Bain may be part of the same political relationship. By the way, that is in the post that I will excerpt. The Poma family, P-O-M-A of El Salvador, also counted among the original Bain investors. The Pomas, one of the 14 families that owned El Salvador, were prominent backers of the late Roberto Dabuisson. Kingpin of the Urania Party, Dabuisson presided over the death squads that bloodied El Salvador on behalf of that country's fascist owners and with the direction from elements of U.S. intelligence. Dabuisson was nicknamed Blowtorch Bob by U.S. acquaintances because of his penchant for torturing captives with a blowtorch. Listeners seeking background on the genesis of Latin American death squads and their links to international fascism and some elements of U.S. intelligence are referred to AFA number 15. The available evidence suggests that Bain may well have served as a money laundering vehicle. Again, referencing the post, Bean Romney Spooks and Death Squads by Joseph Cannon on his Cannon Fire website of July 5th of 2012. And this is from Cannon Shot 2, Hughes on First at Bain Capital. This I posted on July 15th of 2012. Hughes on First is a reference to Howard Hughes. Now, this post is, again, from the Cannon Fire website. Bain Romney, the CIA, and, in parentheses, God help us, Howard Hughes. Updated, a mystery solved by Joseph Cannon on the Cannon Fire website of July 12th of 2012. Again, due to the limitations of time, I'm not going to read the excerpt. It is in the Hughes on First post and also will be in the description for this program. Howard Hughes, of course, had what was known as his Mormon Mafia. And skipping down in this post, I comment, in addition to elements cited in the first of Cannon's posts about Bain, the Vermittler's business and its participants bring a number of things to mind in connection to Bain-linked elements, which include Miguel Dueñas, scion of another of El Salvador's 14 families, Pancho Soler, S-O-L-E-R, by Dueñas, D-U-E-N-A-S. Pancho Soler, S-O-L-E-R, another member of the El Salvadorian elite and alleged to be linked to Howard Hughes' milieu. Diego Ribadeneira, R-I-B-A-D-E-N-E-I-R-A, a former Ecuadorian foreign minister. Always remember the CIA's profound connections to Latin America, as well as the overlapping links of the underground Reich. Frank Kardonski, K-A-R-D-O-N-S-K-I, a native of Panama and heavily involved with promoting that country's business interests, interests that are inextricably linked with money laundering and other questionable activities. Kardonski bought Key Biscayne Bank from Nixon crony Bebe Rebozo. That bank has been alleged to have been a vehicle for contributions to Nixon's campaign from Howard Hughes. In light of the real possibility that Bain is a front for funny money, unquote, we note that Paul Manning notes that Bebe Rebozo's bank was also a money laundering vehicle for Borman Capital money. Quote, the German South American group also had direct access to the Nixon White House through their representatives in Washington and were proud of the fact that Bebe Rebozo was President Nixon's closest friend. Foreknowingly or unknowingly, Rebozo processed millions of the Borman Organization's dollars through his Florida bank as part of normal commercial operations. That's from Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, on page 275. And among the other people involved with the Vermittler, Frank William Bill Gay and Robert C. Gay. The former was Howard Hughes' chief of staff, the latter his son and managing director of Bain Capital. Frank Morse, a former attorney for Howard Hughes and someone alleged to be on good terms with the CIA. Robert Bennett, close associate and informant for Bob Woodward during the Watergate investigation, and someone with links to the CIA and the Howard Hughes milieu. And by the way, I did a post also during the campaign. This is called Nazi-Linked Pied Piper Ron Paul. All roads lead to Romney from April 8th of 2012. And from the Washington Post of February 1st of 2012, there's an article by Amy Gardner. For Paul and Romney, a strategic alliance between establishment and outsider, unquote. An outsider belongs in quotes. Excerpting, despite deep differences on a range of issues, Mitt Romney and Ron Paul became friends in 2008, the last time both of them ran for president. So did their wives Ann Romney and Carol Paul. The former Massachusetts governor compliments the Texas congressman during debates, praising Paul's religious faith during the last one in Jacksonville, Florida, immediately afterward, as is often the case, the Pauls and the Romneys gravitated toward one another to say hello. The Romney-Paul alliance is more than a curious connection. It is a strategic political partnership. for Paul an opportunity to gain a seat at the table if his long-shot bid for the presidency fails, for Romney a chance to gain support from one of the most vibrant subgroups within the Republican Party. I would submit that Ron Paul also was sort of a right-wing Ralph Nader, hoping to siphon enough of the youth vote off to his direction to compromise or perhaps to give Mitt Romney the victory in 2012. By the way, we have noted in the past that the primary bankroller of Mitt Romney's of Ron Paul's super PAC was Peter Thiel, and that super PAC is in Provo, Utah. Of course, Romney is a member of the Church of Latter-day Saints. Provo, Utah, a suburb of Salt Lake City. Peter Thiel, of course, is someone who is also the main investor in and CEO of Palantir, which, disclaimers to the contrary notwithstanding, appears to make the Prism software at the very focal point of the L'Affaire Snowden, so to speak. By the way, guess who is also a big backer of Bitcoin? From the ValleyWag blog of May 16th of 2013, we have the following from Sam Biggle. Former PayPal CEO signs off on Bitcoin. Before he was one of the most powerful venture capitalists in the world, Peter Thiel created PayPal, which deals in real dollars and boomed accordingly. If you think this might make him wary of unregulated internet funny money, you're wrong. $2 million wrong. Thiel's founders fund just wrapped a $2 million round for BitPay, which helps other companies accept Bitcoin payments, namely for things like electronics, precious metals, and other low-margin products, says TechCrunch. And I will also note that many techno-anarchists are seeing Bitcoin as an alternative to the dollar as world's reserve currency of choice. By the way, speaking of Peter Thiel, rather, from the same ValleyWag blog of September 2nd of 2013, reminder, Peter Thiel is Ted Cruz's gay billionaire ally. This by Sam Biggle. Where does a man like Ted Cruz get the confidence to IRL troll the United States Senate for 21 hours, knowing that PayPal billionaire and Silicon Valley kingpin Peter Thiel has his back? Surely helps. So as we see when we examine, for example, Vontic, a spin-off of Infineon, which is a spin-off of Siemens, and Vontic is a joint venture with Golden Gate Capital, formed by alumni of Bain Capital, we begin to see some of these relationships becoming quite clear. And again, as in the Adam Pennenberg Fast Company article, there is strong evidence pointing in the direction of three Vontic employees as the actual originators of Bitcoin. In the description for this program, we're also going to have a wonderfully written, very insightful op-ed column from the New York Times by Serge Schmemann, World to Washington, Really? Unquote. It deals with how the world is seeing the U.S. as a result of the shenanigans of the Peter Thiel-backed Ted Cruz and some of the others. However, we are all out of time. Please use the SpitfireList.com website. It has all of the posts that I have already excerpted already up. It will have a long and inclusive description for the Record 760, encompassing all of this material. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 760, Bitcoinberg, the Rebels Without a Clue. This has been recorded on October 27th of the year 2013. My name's Dave Emery. Ciao.